Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we take a look at weather and climate today with our two guests, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. Steve directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison, of course, a professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences. Steve, good to see you.
It's great to be here on this cold day.
cold day. John Martin is finishing up with some of his teaching, but he'll be here in just a minute or two. He's a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, and we'll get him on here in just a couple of minutes. But let's talk. And by the way, if you have a weather or climate question, I hope you'll join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Maybe you got a question about our current weather or what we might have in store for us looking ahead. Maybe you've witnessed an interesting weather phenomena lately. Love to hear about it. And also, we've had some wonderful photos over the months from people. Great weather photos, cloud photos, sun photos, lots of good ones. If you've got one, I hope you'll post it on our Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You can post it there. And again, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Steve, you guys recently wrote an article for the Wisconsin State Journal about what goes on to prepare for a TV weather forecast that basically lasts a few minutes. What kind of preparation goes into that?
Lots goes into it, as you can imagine. Because if you're really going to be a good forecaster, you have to be monitoring the weather all the time because it's always changing. So you've got to see what those changes are. As new model forecasting predictions come out, you got to get on top of those and look at what not only what one model is saying, but what one of many models is saying. And then you talk it over with your colleagues and argue about what's going to happen. Sometimes forecasts are easy, but usually when there's precipitation involved, it's a tough forecast. And there are different viewpoints, and so you debate.
So you debate, and the data come from, where do they all come from?
Most of it comes from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. They collect it and make it easily available at variety of sites. For example, there's the Sullivan Office for the southern southeast region of Wisconsin that you can go and get their forecasts as well as their model simulations and data.
I wanted to talk about an opportunity that you have for people to take a free class. We've got you have a MOOC.
A MOOC going on. It's a massive massive open online course. So it's freely available. It's the weather and climate of the Great Lakes region. So if you Google that, you'll find it. Or if you go to Coursera, they're kind of organizing it. You'll find it there as well.
So you're going to talk about the Great Lakes?
We're talking about the weather and the climate around the Great Lakes. So we're looking at current weather and then how that's been changing. Doing the Great Lakes region, have a bias towards Wisconsin, Michigan, got to admit, a little bit of New York. But yeah, we have, I think we're over 4,000 folks taking it now. You could just get online, sign up. You don't have to do it all. You could watch a couple of videos. We got a video. Several, unfortunately, of me talking about the weather and the climate. John does a couple of guest ones as well. The head of the National Weather Service does another guest one. The former president of the AMS and some faculty on our campus also have some guest appearances.
And it's all online.
It's all online. It's all free. We have a forum going, so you could ask your questions, you know, bring up your experiences with regard to weather and the changes we've been seeing. I was on there this morning looking at some of the comments, and there's a bunch of comments already about people talking about how this cold winter and how that's impacting them. Someone posted about the cottages that they have on Lake Ontario and how this kind of cold weather impacts people from going there.
Yeah, well, and again, let's go back to how do you sign up for it? You go...
So I think probably the best way to sign up for it is to Google Great Lakes weather and climate or go to the wisc.edu, our university website, or the place that's hosting it is a company called Coursera, C-O-U-R-S-E-R-A. Mm-hmm. So if you search on that, you'll be able to find it. And I could send the link to Judith, too, and we can post it up on your Facebook page.
And if you did, M-O-O-C for MOOC.
MOOC, that's
and
right.
Weather.
And Weather, Climate, Great Lakes. I'm sure it'll be popping up.
It is definitely going to pop up. Yeah. And as a matter of fact, Judith signed up for your class.
Yeah, I know a lot of people that, you know, I go curling, and people in curling is that, hey, I signed up for your class.
Cool.
So it's going to be fun. I think, you know, I'm really looking forward to it. It's been really interesting for me. It runs 4 weeks, so mm-hmm. a season each week. We started winter this week. So it was really...
Can you go back and see winter? I mean, you know, if you're signing up... Oh, it's already started, and I missed that first.
Yeah, you can still sign up, and then it's going to stay open the whole time.
So you can always go back.
You can always go back, but you have to sign up. So if you're thinking, I'm not going to do this to April, and you don't sign up now, you won't be able to get out of it April. I don't know why they do that, but they do.
Well, it makes sense. Yeah. And John's a guest speaker, and here's John. John, good to see you.
Good to see you, Larry. Hey, Steve.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
John's got at least two great videos of the MOOC in our Great Lakes.
Oh, thanks. Weather. Yeah, I got a face made for radio, though. Don't get all excited.
yeah, right. That's right. You want to see what we look like, you can go to this. Well, they're actually actors just playing us.
Yeah. Oh, well, I tell you what. Good, John and Martin, by the way, good to have you with us.
Good to be here. Thanks.
We have, and we're just talking about the MOOC. We talked a little about how weather forecasters actually, the TV forecasters actually do their job, and we've got a question from Rick and Seymour, so let's go to Rick. Hi, thank you for calling, Rick.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I've just heard from someone yesterday asserting that when they had been at the Glacier Bay in Alaska, that the glaciers had been receding there for at least 200 years, and that the assertions about man-made climate change are not true because they've been receding for that long. I'll listen, take the answer off of on the phone or on the radio.
All right. Thanks for calling.
That's called cherry picking. It may or may not be true. I don't know about exact details in Glacier Bay. There's a lot of reasons why glaciers that are connecting directly to the ocean might be receding over a longer period of time. But another ice-related climate signal that's awfully hard to ignore, two of them actually. One is the recession of Arctic sea ice in the summertime. It's just about disappeared in the last few years, and there's been a downward trend since satellites started observing that comprehensively in 1979. That's awfully hard to argue with. Another one is John Magnuson here at the University of Wisconsin Limnology, Center for Limnology, did a study about 15 years ago now looking at 35 different lakes across the northern hemisphere, each of which has at least a 150-year record of ice on and ice off. And the cumulative results of that study, and they're varied locations across the northern hemisphere, Lake Mendota was one of them. The results of that study are that the ice on dates have shrunk, made themselves further into the season by about 9 days, and the ice off dates have crept up by about 9 or 10 days. So about 18 to 19 days, fewer days of ice on all of those lakes has been the trend in the last 150 years. Boy, that's hard to argue with, because that ice is an integrator of all of the severity of the winter, and that sets that the winter is getting less severe in the northern hemisphere over long periods of time. That refutes your friend's skepticism.
Yeah. And there are glaciers all over the world that are receding, and it's also not just that they started to recede several thousand years ago when the Laurentine ice sheet was going backwards when we were coming out of an ice age, but even in the tropical regions, you're seeing that on Mount Kilimanjaro significantly getting smaller. So it's not just important to look at is it happening, but what the rate is, and that rate correlates very well with the warming that we've been observing.
Yeah, and it's always easy to find something that someone can kind of ballyhoo as being a point against this or that idea, but one has to look at the comprehensive collection of data and then consider that before coming to a conclusion about what it says, I think.
There was just a news story that one of the scientists most often cited as an authority who doesn't believe in global warming or human-caused global warming has taken millions from the fossil fuel industry. Mm. I don't know if you saw that.
I did, yeah.
Yeah, I saw that too. It was in the New York Times or the Washington Post?
No, New York Times on Sunday, anyway.
Yeah.
And anyway, he had failed to declare that conflict of interest, which I think is...
It's kind of important to, you know, right. And this particularly when they're political groups, you know, who have an objective, and clearly that was the case in this situation, and as a result, it influenced his research and what he was doing and what he said.
We have Eric in Kenosha with a comment, a question, actually. Hi, Eric. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Well, I thought I'd lighten the topic here a bit, and maybe there's an explanation for it. For about 20 years, this is a local weather thing, I live in Kenosha, and I drove down to North Chicago. It's about 20 miles, and I have to cross the border. And I obviously in Kenosha, I'm on the south portion of Lake Michigan, and North Chicago is a little farther south. And I have noticed, and I'm a scientist, so I try not to bias my observations, that the weather changes almost as if by magic when you cross the border. I don't know what it is. I mean, the scenery changes. It obviously becomes a little flatter and not as many trees. But, you know, if it's snowing in Kenosha, it won't be snowing in North Chicago. If it's snowing heavy, it'll be snowing much lighter. And it just has always seemed to be a very strange thing that I don't have an explanation for it. I would think they would be similar, but and maybe I'm imagining it, but it just has always seemed to be that way. So I would throw that out there.
Does it get better as you enter Wisconsin or worse?
Well, it just it becomes more extreme, whatever
more extreme,
it is.
Extreme.
Not, you know, if it's sunny in North Chicago, it would be sunnier and a little bit warmer. If it's snowing, it's snowing heavier in Wisconsin. It's the precipitation that I noticed the most of.
Yeah, I bet you.
Very strange.
It is strange. I wonder, though, that if it isn't tied to wind direction, because the lake is a factor there. And just a couple of examples that you've suggested could be related to the exact direction. And I'm talking about within 1, 2, 3, 5 degrees on the compass points of the wind direction could make a difference right at that location in all of the seasons that you mentioned. I'm not sure that's the only thing, but it could be one of the leading things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's just harder to assess when you're driving.
So
in a
by
car.
Chance, yeah. The wind. This is where the border is. Also, by chance, is an area where the wind direction.
I didn't even think of that, but possibly Kenosha has a point too, doesn't it? The wind is kind of this kind of a point that sticks out in Lake Michigan, but that's right at the coast. Anyway, it just might be that subtle thing that's very much harder to detect when you're driving can be manifest in some of these changes in the weather that you're noticing. And they don't have to be really big wind direction changes. Really subtle ones can make some of those differences show up, I bet.
Oh, I always figured it was some kind of magic on the cheddar curtain there.
No, we don't.
That's
we don't
what
like,
I was going for.
We don't like magic.
Well, we could always ask the Farmer's Almanac.
Yeah, that's the thing to do. That's the thing to do. There's where the answers lie.
Eric, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'll be back. Take a look some more at the weather right after this look at the news. Stay with us. There's never a shortage of things to talk about when the weather guys come by. Steve Ackerman and John Martin talk about what they've been experiencing or what we've been experiencing weather-wise, what's on the horizon, and certainly answering your weather questions. John is professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison. Steve is, too. He also directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, and always great to have them come by the last Monday of every month. And the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Ron in La Crosse has been waiting a while. So let's go to Ron. Hi, Ron. Thanks for waiting.
Yeah, my question is, and I learned from a course in weather and climatology that the more moisture in the air, the longer it takes, you know, for the air to heat up and the longer it takes for it to cool down. Normally, January is the coldest month of the year. A reason why the coldest temperatures don't occur in December during the winter solstice is because there's a lot of moisture in the atmosphere. I mean, we do live on a water planet, even in the northern hemisphere. And around here in Wisconsin and La Crosse, we have the river valley. But I just wondering, I noticed that January was fairly warm compared to the temperatures we're having this February. And I wonder if the shift in the from January to February as being the colder temperatures might have anything to do with increased moisture in the atmosphere brought on by global warming. What do you say about that?
Yeah, January, this past January, was actually just about average temperature for most of the state. Yeah, and this February is really cold. We're like, most of the state is like 10 degrees below normal or so. It's really cold February. So this will be different in terms of the monthly averages. If you look at the daily average temperatures, our actual coldest time of the year is end of January, beginning of February.
Yeah,
right?
Couple of days of the prior month and the first few in this one. That's
So that January monthly cold temperatures are actually mostly occurring during the end of the month. And that, I don't think it has much of a dependence on the moisture in the atmosphere. And I'm thinking here now water vapor, not cloudiness or precipitation. It's mostly driven by the energy gains and losses by the planet, the gains due to solar energy and the losses due to emission from everything that has a temperature emits it. And as long as we're losing more than we're gaining, we're going to cool down. And we don't catch up. that energy gains and losses balances so that the minimum occurs around end of January.
Yeah, and that's true. Even a mile above the ground, the coldest day at about 1 mile above sea level for the whole northern hemisphere is January 29th. It's right at the end of January. Yeah, it just sticks right out like a sore thumb. And after that, it starts to get a little bit warmer. And as Steve said, that's when you're finally starting to make up the difference in gaining a little bit of energy as the sun comes up at high latitudes and not losing so much overnight.
So adding moisture to the atmosphere may actually take those temperatures and increase them some, but I don't think that the seasonal cycle that we're seeing will change much.
That's right. That's right.
February is such a...
It's a short month.
Everybody I know, at least most everybody I know, is just as soon be done with February on the 2nd.
After Groundhog Day, right? Yeah, why do we have anything else after that?
It's been pretty brutal February this year in North America, but not hemispherically. Remarkably, we're on pace to be warmer than last year's record warm winter.
Wow.
A mile above the ground. Unbelievable.
And of course, once we're done with February, everybody wants to get through March, right? Because it's muddy and brown. Right.
February is the one that seems to be more depressing for people.
I think it's the one where, you know, people are like in January enjoying the winter. I mean, snow on the ground is actually pretty. But, you know, by February, I know I'm getting a little tired of dealing with snow.
Yeah, there we go. Sierra and Madison, it's your turn. Thanks for calling.
Oh, hi. How are you doing?
Great.
Before I ask my question, I just wanted to confirm an earlier caller's observation about the Illinois-Wisconsin state border. I've been watching weather for years and years, and I've noticed that the clouds, it's amazing how sometimes they will end as a cloud front right at that borderline. So I have to confirm that either cold. But I wanted to ask, on the Weather Channel, they said that this severe cold that the United States is getting right now came across the Arctic from Siberia. And they, you know, rolled the planet over rather unnervingly to show how that happened. But I was wondering if that was a normal occurrence. Thanks.
Yeah, that's relatively common for our really severe cold events. We don't get a severe cold event every winter, but when we do, that's usually the way that it takes shape, because the very coldest place in the Northern Hemisphere is northern Siberia, Mongolia, because it's the most landlocked. It gets the earliest snow cover of any place in the Northern Hemisphere at similar latitudes. So it's a really great place to manufacture very deep and long-lasting cold air pools. And when the hemispheric circulation sets up in such a way as to drag that air across the pole, there's nothing really to modify how cold it begins. It stays that cold until it makes its way down to about the Canadian-U.S. border, depending on exactly when it happens. But in early February, there's just not that much sunshine in far northern Canada. When it first invades and goes through whatever customs it has to go through up there, it doesn't stop for long, and it doesn't change much of its characteristic. It's downright cold. And that's very common, actually, for us when we get our really severe cold events.
Oh, there you go. Thank you very much, Sierra, for calling. Chris in Lake Mills, it's your turn. Hi, Chris.
Hi. My question is about aridness. I think there's evidence that shows that the U.S. is becoming arid or more arid overall The Great Lakes are lower in water level. Most of the lakes, I think, in the U.S. are lower in water level. So the water is evaporating. The glaciers are all melting. But it doesn't seem like the ocean level is coming up as quickly as the water is evaporating. Is there any evidence to show where that all that water is going?
That's a good question and something that a lot of people are looking at. And to do that, you got to do it globally. And there's two aspects to this. One is that water vapor in the atmosphere is going up. Because mostly the temperature of the atmosphere is going up, and so there's more water vapor in it. The other thing to think about, though, is that that water vapor gets recycled really quickly. So it comes into the atmosphere, and then it gets wrapped up in storms and then precipitates out. So it's not like it's going to be see this continually big building up of water vapor in the atmosphere.
That's right.
Systems will rain it out.
Yeah, every 9 days, in fact. Every bit of water vapor that's in the atmosphere right now as we're talking to each other is rained out or snowed out or something out in 9 days. The cycle repeats 40 times per year, which is just phenomenal.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And I should note that the Great Lakes water levels are up this year. They got up after the winter.
So. I'd say they stand to do it again because we're at 85% ice coverage, which is close to last year's 92, which we never expected when we were just talking about how cold February's been. You know, December and January weren't so bad. No one expected this in terms of ice coverage. It's going to be another good year for water level in the Great Lakes anyway.
Yeah,
because of that.
That's good. Chris, thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. We have Ron in East Troy. Your turn. Hi, Ron.
Hey, there's been a photo going around on the internet of a rainbow, but instead of being in a nice arch with both ends down by the ground, it looks like a string going across the sky with lots of bends and curves. And I was wondering what the explanation for that is.
And is it part of a cloud? Does it look like it's embedded inside a cirrus cloud?
Well, actually, it looks like almost like a storm shelf where there's a whole bunch of clouds, like a frontal thing almost.
So if it could be doctored. People like to doctor weather photographs. I know we've seen some really interesting ones, for sure. But the other one I'm wondering about, it's not so much a rainbow as a diffraction. And it acts like, when you put crystals in the window and the sunlight shines on it, and then it scatters rainbow on the wall that's opposite of it.
Okay.
And a lot of times those pictures, if that's what it is, we'll also call it fire on ice. Because it gets a very wavy pattern like you're describing and not a bow like a rainbow.
Okay.
And it's up in the ice clouds, really cold clouds.
Okay, it could be either one because the caption that went with it said, "Hey, rainbow, go home, you're drunk." So
that sounds like a doctored one.
Sounds like it was taken in Wisconsin, too.
Thanks, Rod. Oh, let's go to San Francisco, California. David, hi, thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi. Out here in California, we've got a long time drought, and as I understand it, it's based upon the idea that we used to depend upon our the snowpack in the mountains to take care of the water needs for the state. So the snow would melt slowly throughout the year. Sometimes it would last until June, July, even August, and that would provide enough water for the agriculture down in the Central Valley. But the melt has been happening sometimes the same week. Up in the ski areas, they've been hard hit for 3 or 4 years because the snow basically turns either to ice right away or it's been melting within a week. And so there's been almost no snowpack in most of the Sierra Mountains and whatnot. So, of course, that's also true out there in Colorado and the Rockies. So not only is that going to affect our agriculture, many of the states east of the Rockies depend upon irrigation as well as we do. So I'm wondering, I've heard various discussions of this, and they're saying that we've got to plant more trees. And I'm wondering if you have any kind of solutions for global warming in the short and long term. Is tree planting a smart idea, and what coverage should we be doing with that?
Well, I think tree planting is a good idea for addressing another issue, urban heat islands in particular. That helps reduce the warming we see with urban areas. With regard to the West Coast, I was just talking with one of our students about this about a week ago because she's doing some research on that. The snowpack really is important for the water supply for the West Coast, for a lot of the West Coast. And what I was curious about is you've been getting a lot of rain in the Northwest. I mean, in December, San Francisco got a lot of rain from the Pineapple Express.
Yeah.
But it turns out a lot of that is not falling as snowpack. It's falling at low altitudes and thus just running out to sea and not being captured.
Yeah.
So I would think that instead of, in terms of that situation, rather than tree planting, I would be looking at, unless they're arguing this, I would look at ways to capture that water to keep it from running out in the sea. And that's not happening.
Yeah.
And maybe trees is one way to do it, but I would imagine storage bins would be another area.
Yeah, I think trees might help with landslides and water retention in the ground,
well,
the soil
true,
itself,
yeah.
But that's not
that's
really
true.
Usable for agriculture later on. You can't really mine that as you can with the melting snow. Yeah, it's a big deal. Snowpack's an issue. Luckily, this week now, this last weekend and probably extending all through this week, there's going to be some pretty good snows in the Colorado Rockies, probably some of the Wyoming Rockies as well, and that's going to help that region. But, boy, you got a problem in the Central Valley because you're having trouble with the Sierra Nevada, that's for sure.
Sure. Well, if you've ever seen that old movie, it's a Jack Nicholson movie called Chinatown.
Yes.
That's all about California water and the theft of water in the 1920s and whatnot, where there was irrigation up in the mountains. For example, up near Death Valley, Mount Whitney is the tallest mountain in California, and that used to slide down in, the rain and snow used to come down into a beautiful valley up there where they had a lot of fruit growing, and right away somebody bought the water rights and sold it to L.A., and this evil character in that movie Chinatown basically made a desert out of what used to be beautiful orchards up in the mountains there.
Mm.
And that's basically what's been going on in California for decades. It would make sense to me to just clog up the gutters. Every mountain road that happens up there, they put in two gutters, and all of that water then goes to the sea. Probably within a month, mountain water is either in industrial use or it's in the ocean.
Water issue is going to be a big issue, not just on the West Coast, but everywhere.
Yeah, that's for
good,
sure.
Clean water is something we all need. And that's why people are looking at the Great Lakes or
sure.
trying to protect
mm-hmm.
the Great Lakes. For
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, I noticed a big headline today in the Middle East is the recurrence of malaria. And they're talking about it in terms of medicines, but in real terms, malaria has to do with stagnant water or people who are not able to get fresh water, and they're using kind of recycled, filthy water. And so the idea of whether or not water is becoming an industrial necessity and that the economy is based upon that need as opposed to the life cycle of humanity and creatures.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot to think about. And I really appreciate your call, Dave. It's an interesting call. And you also reminded me, I haven't seen that movie in a while, but I remember Jack Nicholson and
his nose is what I remember.
His nose and his teeth. Wasn't it his? Didn't he have some of his teeth pulled out too?
No,
with the pliers?
No, that could be. I just remember the switchblade in the nose.
It was really. He in real life. If you'd suffered through that in real life, boy. I don't know if you could do it. David, thank you. On to another topic here. Let's go to Lisa in Camp Douglas. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. As far as that guy that called about the two weather fronts, the weather,
mm-hmm.
I think that might have to do with the edges of the front, maybe.
Hmm.
You know, like, aren't fronts usually so many miles wide?
Yeah, but they're very many miles wide, hundreds of miles wide, usually. They're zones of contrast, so that's probably not the leading factor, I think.
Yeah.
Okay. No. Okay. Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Doug and Trigo. Hi.
Hey. How's it going?
Good. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey, I'm calling about those people talking about the Illinois-Wisconsin line.
Yeah.
There's a powerhouse right there, oh, about 2 miles across the line between Kenosha and Illinois, and it puts out a lot of moisture out of those stacked tons of it. I was driving into Kenosha today, and it looked like it was moving, and all the leaves are down, so you can see that it's coming out the stack. But there, it was huge. It was very large. It was moving, so you know it's not a cloud. These people were calling in before about the clouds there right on the line, maybe, you know, with a, you know, you got a ceiling there in the atmosphere, that moisture all goes up and kind of settle down, just kind of hang out there. You might get that lakefront stuff in the wintertime. You think that's a possibility that a power plant can have a little effect with clouds, like within a 1 mile, 2 mile radius?
Yeah, that's a documented fact. Not about that particular place, but there's a paper that I read some years ago about a giant power plant down in South Carolina, I think in high elevation western South Carolina, where there's actually some documented evidence that a little bit more snow falls in the immediate downstream location of that power plant when they have cold air outbreaks. And so that's probably the power plant exhaust fueling the production of snowflakes. So if you've got something like that going on in the background in northern Illinois, southern Wisconsin, and then you put this cloud of extra water vapor in there from the power plant, it could very well give you a little bit of local enhancement that you just might notice by eye.
There you go.
Quite possible.
All right. Thanks, Doug. Good comments. Well, they're all good comments. Chris in Appleton. Hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. So you had a question about jet contrails.
Uh-huh.
I heard something about the government seeding the skies or something for rain.
Yeah, there's a conspiracy theory out there that those are not, that they're chemical trails and they're not really condensation trails, basically a cloud formed by the mixing of the hot, warm air coming out of the engines with the cold environment. But yeah, it's just a conspiracy. I've flown in those things. We've collected them. We've observed them. It's water. They form as tiny little water droplets first and then freeze, become ice crystals.
Huh. Yeah. Oh, okay. All right. Thanks.
Sure. Yeah, thanks a lot. Mike emailed us and wondered what you think about David Keith's proposal to spray 10 to 20 megatons of aluminum oxide nanoparticles into the atmosphere in order to mitigate climate change.
Yeah. I think it's ludicrous, in one word, because there's so many things that could
go wrong.
What you'd say after the experiment, you'd say, who could have possibly imagined these things would go wrong? I mean, there's so many unintended consequences, and you start screwing around with the atmosphere in ways like that. It's ludicrous. That's my opinion.
And it's also economically probably not feasible, because it would take a lot of energy to do it.
Is there any pie in the sky? I mean, are there any... anybody thinking about ways?
People are looking at it. Geoengineering, it's called. You know, they're saying, well, we're causing the global warming, so there should be something that we should do to counter-affect it. But I agree with John that there's so much we don't know. Yeah. I mean, we did not intentionally cause this kind of warming. I mean, we knew for a long time that it was possible due to the carbon dioxide properties. But to see the patterns that we're getting is not something that we knew or intended. And it's very dangerous.
I think we're going to try and mount some sort of, you know, popular campaign to take some action, the action ought to be the most obvious thing, which is let's just figure out some other ways to power our economy over a long period of time. It isn't going to happen overnight, but let's do it over a long period of time. But you got to dedicate ourselves to doing it right now. We got a lot of smart people in the world, most of them we'd like that solution to be done in the United States so we're not vassals to somebody else who figures it out, but we can do that.
Yeah.
We had Paul emailed us and said last November, December, you guys were talking about a weak El Nino, which usually would make us warmer. We did seem to have a warmer December and January. But then February, ouch. Did El Nino form or did it?
No, it never formed. No.
It did not. No. Really interesting.
And I actually looked at it before coming over here that they're now forecasting a 50% chance that it might develop in the spring and fall. Yeah. But
We had a really good talk in our department on last week, I guess maybe it was Monday or Wednesday, about a scientist trying to describe the bad forecast, what went wrong. And I think the bottom line is we just don't understand the phenomena that well.
And seasonal forecasting is really tough.
Yeah, it's really, really hot. And so I think that's one place where we seem to have developed some sort of confidence that we can make them. And I'm glad to see that there's occasions where it's clear we don't have that ability, because that means we don't understand the phenomena that well and we need to study it more.
Yeah, when you went and if you go and look back at the NOAA forecast for wintertime, it was a, you know, 30%. It could be anything, they said.
That's
30%
right.
30% chance either way. But no one predicted, you know, that this could be our top 10 coldest Februarys?
Yeah. It's incredible.
Here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, in southern Wisconsin.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. Well, here we are out of time. Wow. Boy, that flew.
How'd that happen?
That flew by.
1 minute at a time.
Yeah.
You guys are going to be back and be with us again the last of March, though, aren't you? Last Monday.
If Judith lets us in the door.
Yeah, right. Some questions remain.
Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our weather guys from the UW-Madison, they'll be back the last Monday of March, and we will talk with them again. Tomorrow, Dr. Kerry Donahue, our veterinarian, with us to talk about ideas for treating your pets. You stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.